It seems like an odd thing to tout the authenticity of a collection of bogus stuff. But Earl Havens assures me what I'm about to see here on display in the hallowed halls of the George Peabody Library is the real deal. Havens is a Johns Hopkins curator of rare books and manuscripts. He's wearing round tortoiseshell glasses and a burgundy velour blazer. He sort of looks like an academic professor who might moonlight as a carnival midway pitchman. With a dramatic sweep of his arm, he welcomes me to what he proudly calls
the world's largest collection of primary sources, that is, rare books and manuscripts on the subject of deception, fakes, lies, and forgeries.
On display here are the highlights of the Bibliotheca Fictiva collection of Arthur and Janet Freeman. These literary shams are now part of the Sheridan Library collection of Johns Hopkins University, and they encompass nearly 2,500 years of human history. In other words, we've been lying for a long time.
I would assume that we probably learned how to fake, lie, and make forgeries, at least at the dawn of writing, if not at the dawn of the invention of language itself.
I suspect it was something inherently authorial, so to speak, about the written word that, sort of immediately inspired people to subvert that authority.
Well, you would think so. There's this phrase, it is written. And it's this idea that if something has been written down and recorded from the long shadows of history, that somehow that was meant for us to believe and to appreciate because it was worth commemorating in written form. And I think that forgers take advantage of that sensibility, because when print is invented, you suddenly can reproduce your cockamamie ideas for the universe, for thousands of readers across Europe. And it's no surprise then that one of the great concentrations of forgery come from the period of the invention of printing and the century that ensued.
So let's get into the collection and have a look at some of these historical whoppers. There are 65 of them on display here in the gallery adjacent to the Peabody Library's grand reading room. These are yellowed, time-worn books and manuscripts in lighted plexiglass cases. Curator Havens points out a book that was published in 1773. This is the account of a Dutchman named Pas van Krienen, and in it he documents an archaeological expedition and the discovery of a remarkable tombstone.
So Pas van Krienen, in the account, describes how his servants were digging and digging and digging for weeks and weeks and weeks, found nothing, until one moment they found this gigantic tombstone. And on it is this remarkable inscription. They begin to move the tombstone, and Pas van Krienen is the first man to gaze through the little crack that was made by their movement of the tombstone. And what did he see but the body of Homer sitting at a table with an ink pot and a pen and a piece of parchment to write down the next great epic poem. Unfortunately, his servants couldn't handle the weight of the tombstone. It fell, and Homer turned to dust.
So Pas van Krienen was the only man ever to gaze upon the visage of Homer since the days of antiquity. And then this great discovery vaporizes right before his eyes.
Now, why would you do this? Why would you make up this preposterous story? Well, as it turns out, in the late 18th century, there was a huge debate among scholars about whether Homer ever existed, about whether there was one Homer or many Homers, and whether he could read, because, of course, the poetry was communicated orally. So forgeries fill in gaps very often in history. They wish to inform us about things that we wish were true.
How interesting that he was discovered, this master of the oral tradition, the epic poem, with an ink pot.
Yes, well, it's so convenient because, of course, then he could write as well as read.
When you think about a lie of this daring magnitude, it begs the question, what in the world would motivate someone to do it? Curator Havens has thought a lot about what must have compelled these forgers on.
What is the greatest virtue that one can achieve? What is the greatest sign of achievement before the Nobel Prize? Well, it's eternal memory. It is to be remembered forever. The great Renaissance poet Petrarch once said, "All that we have read becomes our own until failing memory robs us of it." I put it to you, I think, my theory, they didn't give us an instruction manual on their intentions, these forgers. But what I think is their principal motivation is so that we will do what we're doing right now, which is 200 and something years later, we're still talking about these people.
If it was eternal memory these falsifiers were after, they've gotten their wish in this archival collection and the burgeoning field of academic study that investigates forgery as a mode of creative literature. Curator Havens points out a book by a gentleman from a small town in Italy, a guy he calls the most ingenious forger of the 17th century. His name?
Curzio Ingarami. His great book published in 1637, one of the most beautiful books published in the 17th century. He was a very young man, and one day he was walking along his estate in Volterra. He wants Volterra to be very important in the history of the world. He actually wants it to be one of the epicenters of culture and knowledge and wisdom in the world. And in order for that to be true, he has to cause the oldest people in the history of the world to have lived there. And so he decides to discover on his estate Scariths.
Help me out. What are Scariths?
Well, we're looking at an image of one. It's a capsule, you know, a time capsule. And it's made from bitumen and grass and soil and wax and other things. And it was fashioned by the ancient Etruscans, who knew they were about to be destroyed, their culture, by the Romans. And it turns out that the Etruscans, according to Curzio Ingarami, were the most ancient wisdom culture in the history of the world. It wasn't the Egyptians. It wasn't the Greeks. In fact, the Greeks are newcomers. It was the Etruscans, those people who lived in Etruria in Tuscany. And so he decided to bury these time capsules and then unbury them. And inside the Scariths are these manuscripts, which you see in facsimile. And these manuscripts reveal the prophecies of Prospero of Fiesole, the last great priest of the Etruscans.
So now this small and not so consequential Italian town of Volterra becomes a monumentally important historical hotspot because this ancient Etruscan reveals in his newly discovered prophecy,
I am Prospero of Fiesole. I have learned the secrets of nature. I read all of these ancient languages, so forth and so on. What does he predict? He predicts there will be a great man who will come in the world shortly after my death, for whom they will change the calendar. And of course, that means that Prospero knew that Jesus Christ was coming. And that means that the Etruscans were actually Christians, they just didn't know it. So he's rewriting history and making the pagan culture of antiquity actually acceptable to a Christian or a Roman Catholic world culture later. So he's making everything line up so that actually this part of Italy is a origin space.
See, when you start looking into forgeries from this historical era, you start to see that there was kind of a twisted patriotism at work. People wanted to put their country on the map. For example, there was a guy in Basel, Switzerland, back in the 16th century, and he thought, these Alps are pretty tall mountains, probably tall enough even to be seen poking out above the cresting waters of the biblical flood. And of course, there's a reasonable chance then that Noah could have landed his long-drifting ark up there. So, in 1557, this guy took it upon himself to write a history book.
It's a legitimate history of the earliest Germanic tribes by Wolfgang Latius. But he decides to demonstrate in this one page a facsimile of Noah's own original Hebrew inscription in the Alps just outside of Vienna, that he has decided to make Vienna his hometown. So we are looking at a facsimile of the absolutely definitive inscription in stone that Noah settled Austria.
Filling in the gaps in biblical history, this was fertile territory for the forgers of old, who took on the authorial mantle of archaeologist or scholar to authenticate their discoveries. But there is one mantle that's about as authoritative as it gets when you're talking about religious documents. The Bibliotheca Fictiva collection includes a letter written posthumously from heaven by Jesus Christ.
And by the way, this is the first chain letter. It actually says, he that destroyeth this letter will be cursed. He that propagateth and reproduceth this book will be blessed.
And what news does Jesus have to bring us from this letter from heaven?
Well, it's good news. It's evangelism, literally good news. Jesus never wrote anything down, so he dictated this letter to Gabriel. Gabriel sends it down to the earth, puts it under a rock. The rock essentially tells you to pick it up, but nobody can pick up the rock until a boy without sin picks up the rock. Does this sound familiar? Arthur and the sword and the stone.
It's a letter instead of a magical sword named Excalibur.
Exactly, but you know these myths derive from one another. They're connected, and when you pick up this letter and you read it, after it tells you how you'll be blessed by reproducing it, or cursed if you destroy it, it decides to change the Sabbath from the Jewish Saturday to the Christian Sunday. It's a bit of unfinished business, I suppose, in the idea of the development of Christianity, because in the origins of Christianity, it is largely a tradition within Jewish culture. It is only later that it emerges as its own religion, and as a result, it needs its own Sabbath.
This letter from Jesus Christ is printed on a rare 18th century broadside, and next to it is a drawing of the author. He looks like, well, the way Jesus always looks in pictures, which begs another question.
How do we know what Jesus looked like? Well, that's thanks to a medieval forgery, the letter of Publius Lentulus to the Senate of Rome, in which he gives a firsthand description of the visage of Jesus. And he describes his hair as chestnut and smooth down to his shoulders, but then it curls a bit. And his eyes are gray. He has no pimples, and he never laughs. This is the description of Publius Lentulus, who never existed. And this is one of the sources of tens of thousands of paintings of Jesus Christ.
That's a pretty good one, Publius Lentulus. You basically punked every artist from Leonardo da Vinci to Paul Gauguin. Creating forgery can be a pretty liberating creative exercise when you think about it. Exhibit curator Havens points out a book from relatively recent history, 1930. The title?
Lobagola, An African Savage's Own Story. Bata Kindai Amgoza Bin Lobagola.
It's the story of a man born in deepest, darkest Africa. Terra incognita, as it would have been labeled on maps from the era. In the book, we learn that this man reveals he's descended from the lost tribes of Israel. So he's actually a Jewish African. And he has an amazing life story. He survives lions and crocodiles and goes on elephant hunts. And then he travels to England and from there to North America. And this man, Lobagola, his life story gets chronicled in a series of magazine articles. And then those articles get published by Alfred A. Knopf, the great literary publisher of the 20th century. If only the story were true.
It turns out that Lobagola was actually born in Baltimore, and his name was Joseph Howard Lee. The hoax was fascinating because what he was trying to do, he was African-American and he was gay. And so he wished to emancipate himself from the prejudices of his own moment by inventing an extraordinary story which actually would have lifted him in the eyes of Americans, of Baltimoreans, in the 1930s. And so he was actually be treated, quite literally, like a prince.
This really brings us to the heart of what fascinates curator Earl Havens about forgeries. He says when most of us hear the word forgery, we think of fake paintings or counterfeit money, mercenary acts of deception. These are designed with one goal, to get rich quick. But there's another aspect of forgery that scholars have not spent a lot of time on.
And that is how creative forgery is. That forgery, in a sense, is a form of literature. Forgery is not unlike satire, for example, as a mode of creative composition, imaginative literary production. And so one of the things that we're hoping from this exhibition is to communicate to people that we really need to think about forgery as a serious form of creative, dare I say, virtuosic literary production.
Part of this exhibition's goal is to celebrate the creative and virtuosic side of forgery. Another part of it, though, is to showcase the great damage that can be done when a forgery is created with evil intent. Havens points to a book titled The Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
This is a pernicious forgery. It began with a short story, actually, a French short story in the middle of the 19th century, but was very quickly picked up by the Nazis. And here we're steadied in front of the very first German edition of this forgery called The Protocols of the Elders of Zion, in which it reveals to all those who have doubt about the real power in the world. The world is being taken over by Jews. There's a Jewish conspiracy to insinuate Jewish authority and Zionist control over the wider world. This was used as a warrant for genocide, as one scholar has described it. This is a document that is still used by terrorists to describe a Zionist plot to take over the world.
I guess it just goes to show you that, whether factually based or completely invented, for whatever motivation, if something is reproduced and circulated enough, it gains its own air of authenticity.
Yeah, especially when you produce hundreds of thousands of copies and you literally flood the reading audience, so to speak, with this text. And that's where the duplicative power of print becomes pernicious. Not just forgery, but the technology that allowed so many of these artifacts to circulate in the wider world and to be produced and reproduced and commented upon, propagandized, appropriated, politicized, imitated, illustrated. I mean, the whole story is a fascinating arc of human inventiveness and human prejudice and destruction.
And I suppose to extrapolate that to the present, when you think about the ability of a literature to be reproduced, I mean, now that happens at light speed.
Right, and I'm actually waiting to hear, I'm waiting to see lots of new hoaxes that will be perpetrated in this universe of the internet. I actually made the argument to my colleagues at the libraries here in discussing whether we should make this a part of our collections. I said, there's no more important time in the history of ideas to be a place that focuses on human deception and the question of the authenticity of source materials. Some students at Johns Hopkins think that research is going to Google, and the quickest thing, the easiest thing that you find is research. No, research is hard. You have to dig to find authentic material, and more now than ever before.
I feel like the moral of this visit is if you create something that people want to believe, somebody, it is very easy to make them believe it.
And somebody is going to believe it. Hoaxes are meant to deceive gullible people. Many of these forgeries were immediately rejected by the reading public, but there's always going to be somebody who sees that newspaper at the grocery store checkout that says that Elvis was spotted at the George Peabody Library yesterday, and they will read the article because it sounds so interesting and possibly true.
Earl Havens, it's really been a pleasure. I thank you for the tour, and congratulations on a remarkably inauthentic collection.
Right. I love saying this when I talk about this collection. Everything I've told you is completely true. It challenges, it beggars the mind, but it also, I think, is a testament at the end of the day to the human impulse not only to deceive, but to invent.
Fakes, Lies, and Forgeries, the exhibition of rare books and manuscripts from the Biblioteca Fictiva collection, is on display at the George Peabody Library through the end of January. You can find a link to more information about it at our website, wypr.org/programs/signal. For The Signal, I'm Aaron Hinken.